Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a conversation with Phoenix's former and now new city manager.
And how a soap advertisement helped launch the career of comedy icon Rita Rudner.
A few years ago, Roshai Montaño graduated from Stanford University, and she got a fellowship at the Heard Museum. During her orientation, they took her on a tour of the museum's archives. One painting in particular caught her eye, Rose and Coyote Dressed Up for the Heard Show, by Harry Fonseca, an indigenous artist of Nisenan Maidu, Hawaiian, and Portuguese descent. It's a striking image, two coyotes dressed in human clothes against a purple backdrop. One of them wears a black leather biker jacket and black leather boots. The other wears high heels and a bright dress with a floral pattern. Roshai couldn't stop staring at it.
I immediately resonated with it on multiple levels. I thought it was just incredible to gaze at, but also I felt like there was an inherently queer undertone to it.
Rose and Coyote reminded Roshai of the time she had spent back in college exploring San Francisco's queer community.
When you look at Coyote specifically, he's clad in leather, and he's wearing these heeled boots, chains, all of these kind of silver adornments all over. That was one aspect of it, because I've visited Folsom Street Fair, and there is a leather culture there that I was familiar with. And then Rose, she's just, like, hyper-glamorous.
And Rose is the other figure in the painting.
She's Coyote's counterpart. I thought that was fantastic, and I was wondering just all of these questions. Is this Coyote in drag? What's the connection?
For Roshai, the idea of an indigenous artist painting queer characters was a revelation.
Especially when I was growing up and in my own culture, in my Diné community, it's not something that was really talked about. And expressions of gender has always just been interesting to me, and how you identify that to another person and how much someone can read from you based on that performance.
The more Roshai dug into Fonseca's work, the more she began to wonder about Fonseca's relationship to performance and to Coyote.
I felt that perhaps Fonseca identified with Coyote in that way, and I think maybe Harry felt that there was a little bit of Coyote in everybody.
One afternoon, a few months ago, I visited Roshai at the Heard Museum, and she showed me a series of Fonseca's paintings on the wall in one of the galleries. We spent a while looking at one that shows Coyote on a stage with velvet curtains, wearing his leather jacket and ballet shoes, leaping and twirling with another coyote who's wearing a tutu. Roshai sees this painting as a comment on the flexibility of indigenous identity, Fonseca declaring himself as someone who refused to be categorized.
Fonseca places Coyote in all of these kind of fantastic spaces and occupies different identities in a lot of his work.
In hearing you say that, it makes me love this image even more, because not only is Coyote at the ballet, Coyote is at the ballet in a motorcycle jacket.
Yes.
Like, doing it the Coyote way.
Mm-hmm. I always wondered if, in terms of all of these different embodiments of Coyote, how much of that was that Fonseca himself, and if he kind of just felt liberated in portraying Coyote in that way.
In that that first painting that caught Rochai's eye, the one with Coyote in biker gear and his counterpart, Rose, in the floral dress. Rochai wonders if Fonseca saw himself in both figures.
Rose really was kind of this extravagant, glamorous, native auntie symbol, I would say, because he would watch his auntie going out for a night out, and she would just be, her heels would be high, her dress would be short, and her makeup would be done. And I love this mixture of gender identity and also going against the preconceived notions of male gender and female gender.
Elsewhere in the gallery, Rochai showed me another one of her favorites. This one was a black and white line drawing. Two coyotes sitting at a bar, one wearing a fedora and the other with a bow in its hair. They're staring into each other's eyes.
What really drew me to this is this really softness in the intimacy between the two coyotes, and I think there's a longing there.
Yeah, they both have their hands on each other's backsides.
Yes.
But it could be friendly or it could be romantic.
Exactly, and I love that ambiguity. I think there's also an ambiguity of gender as well. And I wondered about that exploration that Fonseca was taking in his work.
This exhibition that we were walking through was called Harry Fonseca, Transformations. Rochai was the curator for the exhibition. To prepare for it, she pored through correspondence between Fonseca and his friends and interviewed many of the people who knew him before his death in 2006. She discovered that Fonseca was inspired by the coyote trickster archetype from indigenous lore, and that Fonseca had spent a lot of time in San Francisco's queer neighborhoods, just like she had. And as she was analyzing one of his paintings, Coyote in the Mission, she spotted the word Folsom written on a brick wall behind Coyote, which made her think about her own experience at the Folsom Street Fair. As Rochai began to narrow down the works she wanted to feature, she realized she was also creating a kind of meta-work, choosing a group of paintings and drawings that added up to a portrait of Fonseca himself.
I was finding like little hints or crumbs that I thought were interesting that kind of built this story that I was interested in. And so I was like, I wonder if there's something there, something deeper. And so it just kept building and building.
That story Rochai is interested in, the story of gender and how it's performed in indigenous art and culture, it's really important to her. She sees it as part of a larger narrative about how colonial forces have suppressed the diversity of indigenous life.
It's just profoundly interesting to me. I remember reading this book, and the first line read that, you know, just to paraphrase, Native people at one point were just like the queerest people in the world. And I thought that was so funny, but also incredibly true.
Rochai also told me that all the while she was studying Fonseca, she knew that this version of him was filtered through her own experience. She wanted to explore his identity without trying to define it, though she says she talked to one of Fonseca's friends who described Fonseca's sexuality as kaleidoscopic. In her research, she also found a comment Fonseca made at one point when someone asked him what his coyotes represented. He gave a somewhat winking reply, quote, "They're just coyotes." But in another interview he gave once, speaking to a fellow artist named Lorenzo Baca, Fonseca said something which suggests he would have been open to Rochai's interpretations of his work.
It seems that all art makes some kind of statement, even if it just sits there and doesn't do much of anything. So as far as my coyotes making statements, yeah, they do make statements. I'm not certainly sure, you know, what those statements are.
Talking to Rochai, I got the sense that looking at Fonseca's coyotes and trying to figure out exactly what he was saying isn't really the point. The point is to keep looking.
The motorcycle jacket, the glitter, the extravagance, everything. It's just, how can you not look at it and have questions?
Roshai Montaño is an assistant registrar at the Heard Museum.
The dust has settled from November's elections, but not for one woman who found herself on the ballot earlier than expected. Julie Spilsbury was recalled from the Mesa City Council after 5 years. The race pitted her, a politically homeless Republican, versus a challenger endorsed by Turning Point USA. Spilsbury was targeted by the right-wing activist group after publicly endorsing Democrats Kamala Harris and Ruben Gallego in 2024. The recall effort hit home for her and still stings, but she told me she has no regrets. Spilsbury grew up in Mesa, around the corner from her now husband. They chose to stay in Mesa to raise their 6 kids there. When they were younger, she was really involved in their schools. And then former Mesa mayor and fellow anti-Trump Republican John Giles asked her to run for city council.
I started watching all of the meetings, and there was no mother on the city council at the time. There was only one woman out of 7. And I realized really, and she wasn't a mother. And so I realized really quickly that my voice was not represented on the city council. And so I just felt like that was the next best place to serve a city that I love.
At first, she said she had imposter syndrome. But then she told me a Facebook comment changed her mind.
Someone that I went to high school with involved in politics in our area wrote on Facebook that I was too compassionate for politics, and that kind of lit a fire under me. And compassion's my superpower. I bring cinnamon rolls to meetings. I'll bring cinnamon rolls to you if you are mad at me and before I'm ever going to yell at you, right? Like, I'm a mom of 6, and I am not embarrassed about that. And I got to bring that, like, who I am, my voice, my emotion, my deep compassion for people.
But that is what may have led to her political downfall. Before she became a pro-Kamala Harris Republican, Spilsbury supported a city non-discrimination ordinance that she saw as protecting her LGBTQ friends and family. But critics said allowed transgender women to use women's restrooms. And she voted to approve housing the homeless in a Mesa hotel.
You know, truly, there's just so, like, homeless is just one more group, like immigrants, refugees, veterans. Like, there's so many people on the edges of our society that need a voice and that need people to fight for them. And I don't view that as conservative or liberal, but it definitely made me a target.
Recall organizers also criticized her votes to raise council member salaries and utility rates. But she told me the hardest part of being targeted for this recall effort for her was at church. A lifelong member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, she says she's seeing a political divide today, even among her own faith community.
I think I was quite shocked by it. It's been especially hard. I'm still very, very active in my faith. Sorry, you can hear how much pain that
yeah,
this has been.
That's okay.
But just so many people that I go to church with every Sunday, you know, supported the recall and have been opposed to my views for 5 years when I'm just trying to serve a community that I love. And I don't view anything that I've done as being, you know, anti-Republican or anti-conservative. I mean, on a local level, it's more hands-on government. It just is. So, like, you might have like the limited government view, but when you're down in a local government position, it's much more hands-on, and it's supposed to be that way. Local government affects your life so much more than any other level of government, but it's the level that people pay the least amount of attention.
I say that to people all the time as a local journalist.
Yep.
I mean, it sounds like you're a lifelong member of the LDS Church and have 6 kids, like very active in your community.
Yep, five of my kids have served missions.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, so tell us more about that conflict, right? Like, there is definitely, it seems, a branch of the LDS community that have been skeptical of Donald Trump, maybe because of moral issues. Are you in that camp?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it is interesting. It does kind of feel like a divide is happening. And I can't quite figure it out. Our highest leaders of our church have said things like voting a straight party ticket is a threat to democracy. And we should look for candidates who demonstrate integrity and compassion and service to others, and that we might at times have to support candidates or parties that we wouldn't normally support the rest of their platform, and that we should never, ever say that you can't be a faithful member of, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and vote for XYZ. So this is what our top leaders are saying, but it's almost like to a lot of people, the fact that I decided it was very, very hard for me to decide last fall to publicly endorse Kamala Harris and Ruben Gallego, but I could not support Donald Trump and Carrie Lake. And so I came out and that was it. Like that was the thing. Turning point, decided that I had to be out of office, and so many people in my church, in my faith, went along with it. Like, I'll just never understand it. I'm the very first person in Mesa's 140-year history to get recalled.
I mean, what does that feel like for you? Especially because, you know, it sounds like the LDS community in Mesa, I know, is very tight-knit and you're very involved
in
it.
Yeah.
What did you have conversations with these folks? Like, what was this like?
We've been in the same church congregation for 18 years. Our youngest was 1 year old when we moved in, and she's 19 now. Mm-hmm. Like, this is where I, you know, raised my kids. And my husband served as the bishop of our congregation for 5 years. Like, we're very involved in our church community. You know, it is tricky. It is so, so painful and so hard to show up every Sunday when I know that half of my church congregation is mad at me or doesn't agree with me or wants me out of office, right? And so the Sunday after I lost, I didn't even want to go to church. And I was supposed to play the organ that Sunday in our church congregation. And then I got asked to play the piano for a musical number for some of the teenage girls that were singing. And, you know, I believe that we're all worshiping the same God and that we want the same things, and trying to in the LDS faith, we're geographically situated, right? So we attend a church where we live. You don't get to pick where you go to church where you feel comfortable.
Right.
And I think that as hard as that is, that's what helps us to become more like Jesus Christ. And so I got to still show up every Sunday, and I got to experience that friction and that tension with people and still try to see them as my brothers and sisters, and still try to see them, the good in them. And hopefully they can see the good in me and we can move on. But it has been very challenging. It's very hard.
Do you think there's a piece of that that's brought you closer to your faith, maybe because of that challenge?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the most interesting things about this is, like, as I was exposed more to the LGBTQ community and the homeless community and all these marginalized groups, that broke my heart when I sat and listened to their stories. It's actually just made me such a better person, and I have so much more love in my heart, and I'm so much closer to my Heavenly Father. And so I actually am stronger in my faith. But with the people who view me as maybe, you know, wicked or on the evil side, that would be interesting for them to hear me say that, right?
I'm sure. That's former Mesa City Councilwoman Julie Spilsbury. More of our conversation after the break. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, comedian Rita Rudner's legendary staying power.
And now let's return to my conversation with former Mesa City Councilwoman Julie Spilsbury. She was recalled last month after serving on the city council in the East Valley City for 5 years. Right-wing activist group Turning Point USA got heavily involved in the race. Opponents didn't like that Spilsbury, a lifelong Republican who never came around to Donald Trump, endorsed Kamala Harris in 2024. So this was a race, a very local race, right, that became very national because of the attention on Turning Point USA, because this was one of the last campaigns that the founder, Charlie Kirk, worked on before he was assassinated. I wonder, like, is it fair of them in a way? They don't like your brand of conservatism. They don't like some of the votes that you took. Fair enough. Like, this is how politics works. They can get you recalled.
You know, I have got a lot of strong feelings about this. I think it's horrible to bring national political ideologies into a city council. I don't know how I could have ever been able to fight that. I only lost by 762 votes, but to try to, you know, face a national organization, and there were much bigger races across the country.
But I wonder, like, is this, you think, kind of how politics is going to function today or already is functioning today in terms of being able to use this kind of national organization in these very local races and in pretty powerful ways? Is it, you think, not reflecting the will of the voters?
I don't think it's reflecting the will of the voters. I really don't. And especially, again, our school boards, our city councils, they need to stay nonpartisan because every single voice matters. And when you start running partisan races, you have to pander to a group of people. And so you're standing up for what will get you reelected, not for what you think is the right thing to do. And you end up with a lot of politicians and not a lot of leaders, right? So I tried to stand up for what I felt was right. I did it with my eyes wide open. I got recalled for it. I knew that was always going to be a possibility, but I don't have any regrets because I have to live with myself. So I have to do what I feel is right. But I am absolutely heartbroken and sickened. Frankly, I'm horrified that this could be the direction that we're headed, that we're going to turn city councils and school boards into partisan politics.
Right. Do you think that's where it's headed? Like local nonpartisan races are going to become partisan? There was actually an effort locally at the state legislature to make that happen last session. I mean, is this, you think, the future?
I sure hope not. I mean, I don't know. I hope enough people stand up and say, we don't want this. We don't want this. Look, any kind of organization or committee or board, you need diversity. I don't want seven women on our city council. I don't want seven Republicans. I don't want seven LDS people. I don't want seven of anything. I want all the different voices. We are stronger when we have different backgrounds, different, you know, opinions and diversity of viewpoints, and we come up with better solutions to really complex issues when we have all the voices. And I don't think anything could be more harmful to our city than saying we want everyone to think the same way. Mm-hmm. There's no growth in that. There's no learning in that. I'm super passionate about, you know, working across the aisle, bridging political divides. Mesa is amazing right now. Mesa was just voted the number one best run city in the state of Arizona by Wallet Hub. It's number 9 in the nation for best places to live. We're doing really well. And I credit Mayor Giles, and a lot of the magic that's happened on our city council is that we all treat each other with respect, with dignity. We work together really well, even when we disagree. We don't ever make it personal. We don't ever attack each other. And I worry that when we bring in partisan politics, and that's the vibe right now, is we don't want anyone around us that doesn't agree with us. I just can't think of anything more. I'm very worried about the future of Mesa because of that.
So were you or are you surprised that you lost in the end? I mean, they had a lot of money, a lot of volunteers, a lot of people, you know, trying to get votes out against you. But, you know, those people still turned out to vote. You lost by 700 some votes. I mean, were you surprised?
Yeah. I was surprised. I mean, I knew I could lose, of course. I didn't know what would happen. I think it was kind of like just the most beautiful thing that happened with my campaign. I had a Republican campaign manager and a Democrat campaign manager that were both working on my campaign. Mm. I had Dems and Republicans and independents out knocking doors for me for 8 weeks. I had Dems and Republicans writing postcards, making phone calls. Like, it was truly just this really unique, beautiful coalition of people who care about Mesa that came together, and we didn't care what party we were from. And that to me is like, that's my goal. Like, that's what the purpose of this life is. And it was beautiful to see so many people working together. I raised over $100,000 from just tons and tons of small donations from people. I had a lot of support. I had a lot of people that were inspired by me standing up to this as a Republican and not, you know, being afraid and not going along with it just to go along with it. And so I was hopeful that, like, in the end, kindness could prevail. I think way too many people do not pay attention. They just, they got to more people than I did. I don't know. I'm still, 2 weeks later, I'm still just in utter disbelief that it even happened. And I'm really sad. I'm really, really sad.
All right. We'll leave it there. That is Julie Spilsbury, former Mesa City Councilwoman, joining us. Julie, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We also reached out to Turning Point USA to come on the show and did not receive a response. And you are listening to the show. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Phoenix's new city manager started on the job in the middle of last month, but he's not unfamiliar with the position. Ed Zuercher is back for his second stint as city manager. He previously served in the role from 2013 to 2021. After leaving the city, he went to work for the Maricopa Association of Governments, or MAG, as its executive director. His return to city government has been somewhat controversial, though, with some critics worrying about a lack of transparency in the hiring process. Zuercher has said he wasn't necessarily looking to come back to be city manager again, but that he was interested when approached about the possibility. When our co-host Mark Brody spoke with him earlier, he asked about that and what interested him about coming back and doing this job again.
It's the people at the city. It's the work we get to do. It's really those two things. I retired in 2021, but I did not leave the city of Phoenix. I was still a resident and a customer doing other work. So I continue to experience life in the city of Phoenix, and I really love Phoenix. But, you know, the work that gets done at local government and the work that gets done at Phoenix is just so critical to people's everyday lives. You think about water and sewer and airports and streets and police and fire service and just on and on. It's really important work, and it's very interesting work that we do. And then I know the people who work here, and I know they do good work, they're quality, they're committed. And so the idea of coming back to work with the people that I know and getting to know some new people on issues that are really interesting was very intriguing.
Did being a resident, sort of a civilian resident, not, you know, working with the city, did that give you a different perspective that you're bringing with you to your second stint in this office?
Definitely did. You know, I took loads of trash to the dump and was a customer there and had to figure out setting up my water bill and just all those things that you do as a resident that when you don't have the authority of being the city manager, you experience differently. And so I saw the many, many good things that we do, and I saw the places where we could improve from just being one of the folks. I find that sort of thing really interesting.
Did you feel like you had unfinished business when you retired from the city?
No, I really didn't. I felt good when I left the city in 2021. The team that was here, Jeff Barton, very talented and has done a great job in the last 4 years. So I didn't really look backwards at all. But as I've, you know, refreshed and retooled and refueled myself here in the last 4 years, I've gotten back to just really enjoying the kinds of work that get done at Phoenix. And so the opportunity to come back to that work was something that I couldn't pass up.
So I have to ask you about the process by which you did come back, because it has drawn some criticism from some members of the council, some in the public, that, you know, the job wasn't really posted. Your selection was approved, but, you know, just by a one vote majority, no public search, no real interviews. A lot of folks in the public say they didn't have a chance to give input on this. I'm curious what you make of that criticism and of the process that led you back to this job.
Yeah, I understand the critique of that, but I think it's important to know the city council hires two people. They hire the chief presiding judge of the municipal court, and they hire the city manager. And really, the city manager is the one that they work with every day, every hour. So that is their one position to hire, and they need to be very careful with how they do that, and it has to match what it is they're looking for. So there's no set process in the charter. It's just they have the authority to do it. The process by which I was hired is almost exactly the same process that they used 4 years ago to hire Jeff Barton. So it's the purview of the council. It's how the council desires to act. And I was happy to be a candidate for that in their mind and to meet their standard.
Do you think it would have been better, though, had there been a little more openness, a little more public input and transparency in this process, understanding that they're able to do it the way that they did?
I mean, that's really a question that the mayor and the council will have to answer. I think they felt that I had the skills, the talents, the background that they needed to meet the moment. And so I was happy to present myself and be the candidate for that.
What are the things that you think are most important for you and for the council and the city to be tackling right now?
I mean, it's the kind of things you cover on your show every day, Mark, right? It's It's water, it's heat, it's housing, it's affordability, it's energy, transportation, police community relations, all those things that are important to residents in their day-to-day life. And all those things are what have to be tackled. There is no sort of one thing. It's a whole bunch of things that the city is working on and that are top of mind for our residents.
I'm wondering if your time sort of in between being city manager, of course, you were with MAG, the Maricopa Association of Governments. Did that change your perspective all on sort of Phoenix being within this region? I mean, obviously, Phoenix is the biggest city, but there are other big cities in the valley here. I mean, did your experience with MAG help you maybe gain a different perspective on regionalism in this part of the state?
Absolutely. You know, the ability to go to visit every one of the other cities, counties, and towns in our region. There's 32 of them, Native Nations as well. I got to visit every one of them. I got to know their chief elected officer, in many cases their council. I got to speak at many council meetings, see what's going on at the ground level in all those other cities. It was very encouraging. There's a lot of really good stuff going on in other cities. And when you're the city manager of Phoenix or Glendale or El Mirage, you just don't have the time to go and understand what's going on with your peers. I actually had that luxury to do that, and that was part of my job. So I got to see the great work going on in the other cities as well. But I also got a sense of, you know, just sort of what makes Phoenix distinct as the central city. It's where, as the center of commerce, as the downtown of the region, the place where issues like homelessness and service, human services provision really concentrate, and the impact of that on the central city, that is distinctively different from the other cities as well. So just having a better perspective on how we're the same and how we're different, I think gives me a broader perspective and a deeper appreciation for the things that are going on in the region and how Phoenix is a leader in that, but also how we're a partner in that as well.
How might that impact how you do your job when you're talking about, you know, issues like water, like housing, like affordability, which, of course, are not just Phoenix issues, but regional issues as well?
No, you captured it, Mark. The big issues that we face are really regional issues. Air quality doesn't worry about city boundaries. Homelessness does not stop at a city boundary. So having those relationships in the region, I know the city managers and I know the mayors. Those relationships, as we have to grapple with problems on a regional level, I think will serve me, the city, and all of us well.
That is Ed Zuercher, Phoenix's city manager. Ed, thanks as always for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. You know, the word legend gets thrown around a lot in popular culture, but there aren't many artists who fit the bill. Rita Rudner is on that list. She is practically synonymous with Las Vegas comedy, which makes her one of the defining figures of a particular style of American comedy. Her Vegas solo show ran for more than a decade, selling over 2 million tickets. She's done HBO specials, sold out Carnegie Hall, and written 6 books. With a career spanning 50 years and counting, she is still at it. And if the idea of a pioneering female comedian dominating Vegas and still evolving late in life reminds you of the TV series Hacks, well, that is because the character of Deborah Vance is partly based on Rita Rudner. Rudner is performing at Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts this weekend, and I spoke to her recently about the origins of her signature style, which has been described as epigrammatic and rapid fire. She told me that her original plan was to be a dancer on Broadway, which she was, starting when she was a teenager. But after about 10 years in the theater, one day back in the 1970s, she was flipping through the New York Times, and she got an idea.
I was reading an article about soft soap, and it was when soft soap first came on the market, and it was a big hit. And they were interviewing the person who invented the campaign. And he said, well, we had a new idea for a soap. And we said, are we going to do another bar soap? Or are we going to invent a new commodity that doesn't exist that we will have a lot more potential to succeed? So I said, well, why don't I try to be soft soap instead of things that are too crowded? I said, there's just a whole world out there that hasn't been explored for female comedians, so I'll try that.
Yeah. Well, I have so many follow-up questions for you about this, Rita.
Yeah, but we don't have time, so no.
Well, I'll try to get to as many as I can.
No, you say whatever you want. I'm drinking, just so you'll know, I'm drinking an apple cider and Perrier in a glass that my daughter gave me for my birthday. It's very nice.
Oh, okay. What does the glass look like?
It's like a red wine glass, but it has painted flowers and butterflies and pretty things on it because I like that.
That's lovely. Okay, so when you're trying to be an actor and maybe a dancer in particular, there's a way in which you're trying to be similar to other dancers and actors, right? Because there's a form to it. There's a style, and you want to be recognizable as someone who can be part of an ensemble.
Absolutely.
But being a comedian, it strikes me, is entirely different, right? You're trying to stand out as having your own individual voice, somebody, to go with your soft soap example, who is unlike anyone else.
But that, if you're yourself, you're going to be unlike anyone else.
Right.
So
right.
I just said, I'm just going to be who I am.
Uh-huh.
I was an overprotected Jewish girl from Miami. So one of my first jokes was, I wasn't the class clown. I was very boring. I was the class anesthesiologist. There, I remember that one.
Yeah. Can I ask you, Rita, what do you remember about your early experiences of going on stage and doing those jokes?
Oh, it was horrifying. My first time, nobody laughed at any of the jokes I wrote, but they laughed between the jokes.
Interesting.
Yeah, at me being uncomfortable. Very often, a comedian has to have an aura where people want to laugh at you. I said, well, there's something there. Now I just have to get people to laugh at what I'm saying that works, instead of people laughing that I'm saying things that don't work.
So that's interesting. Am I hearing you right then that what you did is you recognized that people were somehow reacting to this aura of you feeling uncomfortable and out of place, and
yes,
then tried to write material that matched up with that aura?
I studied a lot of Woody Allen.
Uh-huh.
Because he was a Jewish comedian that was uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
And then I studied Jack Benny because he was my mother's favorite and he didn't look like a comedian at all. And that's why he was funny.
Interesting. And let me ask you about the style that you ended up with, because one of my favorite things about your work is that, if I may, you're like a punchline machine. It's just like joke to joke to joke. And one of my favorites is, this is from a while back, so forgive me, but you say, all my friends are in therapy. One of them's in aromatherapy. She spends her time telling her problems to a scented candle.
Yeah, I'm glad you like that. That's one of my favorites. You know what? They're all different kinds of jokes, and I try to vary from a punchline to an abstract.
Uh-huh.
And now I do many more. I've introduced stories in my act, which were always a challenge for me. I always admire comedians who had so much self-confidence they could go for like a minute or two without a laugh, you know,
right.
And just talk. And I said, well, I just don't know if I can do that, because I rely on people's laughter. And, you know, I know I do on the average of 3 jokes a minute, because I had to time it out when I did television and I had 5 minutes to do
a
set on Carson or Letterman. And I'd say, oh, let's see how, and I'd time myself and I'd leave them enough for enough laughter. And so I always time myself. But now I'm a bit more relaxed. I'm a bit more, because I've done it so long, I feel like I can afford to be a presence that doesn't have to have a laugh every 30 seconds.
Yes. Well, you know, it's gotten so much more common in stand-up for comics to be very personal, sort of conversational with the audience. And yet, one of my favorite things about that bit that you're doing about the aromatherapy, that's part of a larger bit about aging for women in particular. And,
yes.
You know, you're going from joke to joke to joke, but there's one point where you say to the audience something like, well, it doesn't get any easier as we get older, does it, ladies? And then you hear the whole room like shout back at you like, no, it doesn't. So clearly they're hanging on your every word. There is a relationship there, even if you're not necessarily doing conversational, intimate material.
I like to always choose a premise that is universal. Computers, AI. I had a fight with my AI personal assistant in a rented car in Florida.
Oh, no. What were you arguing about?
Well, she kept calling me Leonard. Anyway, so see what I mean? See, there's lots of things you can talk about that are bothering me today. When a toilet is smarter than I am, it's upsetting.
Well, I would love to ask you just one more question, Rita, if you don't mind.
Sure, anything you need, Mr. Sam.
The co-creator, Paul W. Downs, of the HBO series Hacks, has said that the character of Deborah Vance is partly based on you. And I'm wondering if you have watched the show, and if you have, if you think it's a good portrayal of a journey like your own. I know it's not the same person, obviously.
Well, here's my problem, and here's why I haven't watched it. And maybe I'm being a little bit too precious. You tell me, Sam.
Okay.
I hate the title because it is so disparaging. Mm-hmm. To me, to be called a hack, mm-hmm. is insulting.
Sure.
Like, it's like if you did a show about doctors and said, let's call it butchers.
I appreciate that answer very much, especially because as we've been talking, it's very clear to me how carefully you have thought about your work as a craft.
Yeah, it's really like I go in like a surgeon and I say, I'm really going to try to make this work. And when I try a new joke, I really try hard to put it between two old jokes so I don't let the audience down for like a half a second. I mean, it's my job and I take it seriously.
All right. Well, I have been speaking with the legendary comedian Rita Rudner. Rita will be at the Virginia G. Piper Theater at the Scottsdale Center for the Arts on December 13th at 7:30 p.m. Rita, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Sam, and you have a wonderful day. I'm going to have more of my apple cider and Perrier.
Okay.
As 2025 comes to an end here at the show, we're trying, like many out there, to make sense of a year like no other. So before we look ahead to 2026, we're sharing some favorite conversations from the last year. In March, I sat down with Chris Bianco, a Phoenix-based chef, restaurateur, and James Beard Award winner, to talk about how even the threat of the Trump administration's mass deportations were impacting the restaurant industry. Bianco told me he always follows the law and uses the E-Verify program to make sure that the people he hires have legal status to work here in the U.S. But he described ripple effects from threats of mass deportations and immigration crackdowns and a chilling effect that's hurting an industry already strapped for workers.
Well, you know, I've been in business in this fine city for 34 years, and I like to look at life from perspectives. And my perspective is one that lives on the ground and one that lives in the building where people work. And they come to eat, but I think there's a lot more to it that hospitality provides. And the hospitality worker throughout generations, you know, has been built by, you know, you come here and you work hard, and maybe one day, you know, your grandson will own a pizzeria in Phoenix and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Or hopefully in a quicker time frame that you'll find happiness and health, you know, from whatever situation that you left. I've been lucky enough to have people that work with me that become American citizens and seeing the joy that they and the pride and the knowledge that they have is probably greater than mine about our American history, sadly enough. And for me, I think there's a lot of misconception about what immigrants bring to the table. And, you know, knowing that the hardworking good people that do the jobs that, you know, American kid don't want to do. And that's just, you know, the next, you know, a guy in a dish pit that wants to come that's, you know, coming in from, you know, the suburbs for a summer job. It just doesn't happen. But what does happen to come in that we can e-verify and people that are newer to this country, or they might come to be, you know, relocated from a war zone or from South America, from any part of the world.
So what you're saying, this is an industry that's been built on immigrants.
Yeah, I mean, it is an industry that has not only been built by immigrants and held up by immigrants. And, you know, it is unequivocally, you know, living proof of the American dream, and they can happen, and they do happen. And they, these people pay taxes, and they work hard, and they're pillars in our society, you know? And I think, you know, unfortunately there can be sound bites. There's bad apples in every, you know, basket. And of course, you know, bad apples need to be removed, but, you know, I think the fear that there'll be a lot of good apples caught up digging for bad ones. And, you know, we're still reeling from the pandemic. Like, I mean, you know, we're also in Los Angeles, and we're reeling from, you know, the fires and writer strikes, and, you know, the people that show up, hardworking people, they're looking at the news waiting for the next shoe to drop, mm-hmm. whether it be a pandemic or a mass deportation or some type of issue that will affect a positive, you know, society.
Right. So you've got a restaurant industry that is concerned about this because so many immigrants work in the industry. So many people come from mixed status families.
Yeah.
And you're saying you're still kind of coming off the heels of the pandemic. The restaurant industry is already strapped for workers, right?
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Whatever, you know, the leadership of our country, what I know is I've been through Republican, Democrat, whatever. And I know the people just show up to work for me. You know, they come in all shades and all colors, and they speak sometimes languages that we might not understand at the beginning. But by the end of the day, those relationships grow and they become positive forces in society. And I think those are the stabilities in my life. Mm. Not so much outside forces, but the people that show up and do these jobs every day. And how can we make their lives better? How can they become contributing members of society in a world that is depleted of workers, you know, whether it's picking tomatoes or fruit or the, you know, jobs that are seasonal. You know, sometimes we don't understand the impact of our decisions. And I think we're flooded with sound bites and commercials and fear factors and horrible stories of incidents. And all of a sudden, you know, the world's turned upside down for these people. We just want to make people feel safe, the people that are on both sides of the pass, we say, like in the dining room, in the kitchen. You know, I've been a law-abiding citizen, and I intend to be. We do everything that we can do to verify, mm-hmm. to, you know, be accountable to the laws put in place. But I think it still doesn't change the factor. If someone does come from a compromised, maybe someone in their family or maybe their grandmother, their mother-in-law, whatever,
right.
They might not say, well, I can't risk to go into a restaurant. Maybe that'll connect me to my family. Even if it's unreasonable, the culture that the fear has created has not been a positive one for business, period, for the community, period.
So let me ask you about your willingness to talk about this, right? Like, it's political. Chefs around the country, I think, have been hesitant to talk about mass deportations, fear in the restaurant community and the world there. Mm-hmm. They don't want ICE targeting their restaurant, right? Like, are you worried about sticking your neck out there?
I don't see anything is sticking my neck about anything. I mean, I like to be transparent. All I'm saying is there's a community, I think, that's very unsettled, that feeds our community. And I think if we can work together, whether it's jurisdictions or ICE or government or authority or whatever, to find, you know, peaceful and passive ways to hopefully, you know, restore more of a sense of peace, of calm. And, you know, the reality is there's no one stealing jobs. There's plenty of jobs. If you need one, you come on down. Well, I'm sure we can find one for you.
Yeah.
So I think that's the hard part for business is we don't have people to fill jobs and losing the largest aspect of our workforce, even if it's just by changing the industry, mm-hmm. just by sometimes it's just, you know, it's by association, you know, just like for have maybe somebody wondering your status or your wife's status or your cousin. It's a difficult place to be in or put people in. And
so what can you tell folks? Like, what do you, is there advice? A lot of restaurant owners are giving out cards or putting up, you know, signs in the kitchens, things like that, to sort of inform people of the rights that they have in these situations.
Well, I think, you know, all our workers, regardless, are informed of their rights. And you know, like I said, I obey laws. Even talking about this is, you know, I don't see anything divisive about it. I don't see anything judgmental about it. I just think that there's people that are really good people that, you know, might be in the crossfire of something that's unintended for them, you know, and maybe that just pushes them out of an industry that's already in dire need of a workforce.
All right. Well, I appreciate you coming in. That is Chef Chris Bianco, chef and owner of Pizzeria Bianco, of course. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Mark will have your Friday news tap and all the politics of the week. Don't forget to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org.
See you tomorrow morning at 9. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.